You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 29th of March 2014 on Monocle 24.
Loud and bold, shocking or somber, tasteful and demure, whether it's a supermodel decked out in the accessories of a billion-dollar brand or hard data that sells a news story all by itself, it's open season when it comes to the art of creating the perfect cover. That's the theme of this eye- and ear-grabbing special edition of The Stack. If they say you can't judge a book by its cover, then few would argue the same is true for a magazine. From the weekly TV rag to the multinational fashion glossy, covers continue to be the stuff that turns magazines and their editors and creative directors into legends. But how is this, the most basic of visual entry points, evolving? This week on The Stack, we'll be taking an uncharacteristically skin-deep look at the world of magazines. To help us do this, we'll be joined by a man who, mainly thanks to his cover designs, has given One News Weekly a new position in the marketplace and on the newsstand. And we'll also be looking to our very own creative talent here at Monocle as we speak to the man behind our covers, Richard Spencer Powell.
On the front cover, you have to generate sales, you have to be louder, you have to be noisier, which is quite difficult if you're a somber magazine or if you're trying to be serious.
All that with plenty of gloss to boot on this 83rd edition of The Stack, our dedicated print industry review and analysis show right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio 2 here at Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé. My cover boy today is Richard Turley, the creative director at Bloomberg Businessweek. After starting his career at The Guardian, following a competition victory that offered him a work experience placement, Richard later became art director of the paper's G2 section before moving to New York to work on Bloomberg Businessweek. Turley's covers managed to tread that careful line between being informative and showing genuine creative expression. Inside, he's recreated the notion of pacing and a series of page layouts, which have helped to give the U.S. newsstand a much-needed shaking. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I guess first, compliments all round. If you've been listening to this show, at least sort of over the last sort of probably 80 or so editions, it's amazing how many people come on every week and really hold up this, you know, weekly magazine and just say it's extraordinary what it's done in terms of just that, you know, reinventing the newsstand on one side, or at least one corner of the newsstand, what it's done for covers, and just for the, you know, industry in general. And I guess we're here to talk about covers today and the mechanics of course, delivering something great that comes through a subscriber's door or of course hits newsstand. But just let's go back a little bit. When the call came, or was there an ad posted on the Bloomberg website? You know, how did it all start?
It started through a guy called Jim Kelly, who was the managing editor of Time for a bit. And so Norm Perlstein went to Bloomberg, and he was kind of given the Business Week project and hired Jim to do some consultancy to hire me and Josh, I think, basically, or to hire an editor and a creative director. So I was I just got a call one Monday morning from Jim saying, did I want to, well, it was actually at the time pitched to redesign it. And so I was at The Guardian, so then they kind of allowed you to kind of do a little bit of latitude to do other projects. So I just embarked on that. It was a very random thing. It was not planned. Then it was very quick. Bloomberg being Bloomberg, they kind of move with pace.
Right.
And so I was kind of in New York with a visa, my wife and child, within about sort of 3 months or something ridiculous. It was quite pacey.
Mm. And the mechanics also of you know, you coming together, you mentioned Josh Tieringel, who's the editor of the magazine, and you said that, of course, Norman Perlstein was sort of sitting there in the background. Did you know Josh before? Were you bolted together?
We were bolted together, yeah. We had a couple of calls. We spoke on the phone a couple of times before we actually met. The first time I met him was when I sort of gave the pitch. I you know, they asked me to kind of to present a couple of different options, and that was the first time I met Josh.
But so you were brought in without the editor alongside you to say, this is what my vision of the flat plan looks like. This is how I think we should be doing features. So you were there, of course, delivering a visual. I mean, it had to be a visual, obviously. I'm not sure how much you were able to, let's say, challenge, of course, what the physical piece was, but it was really, you know, just that. It was a look and feel.
I had a brief from Josh. I mean,
sure.
You know, Josh kind of picked, I mean, I think Josh was kind of employed before me, and I was given his, you know, his brief, his spiel about what he thought the magazine would be. And in that was quite kind of specific about design in terms of pacing, in terms of how he wanted to break. I mean, what was clear that they didn't want to do any, you know, they wanted to sort of, the old business week was a big full stop, and then the new one was just something completely different.
Yeah. So I think you had to bolt the Bloomberg word in front of it as well.
So it was through him that, and then I met at the first time I met him though was when I presented it, and then, I mean, they basically offered me the job that afternoon, though. It was, you know, again, speedy. I can remember being on the Van Wyck Expressway, and the phone goes, and it's Josh sort of offering me, saying, do you want to do the whole thing? And so I, you know, said yes. But it was a bit of a kind of whistle stop sort of experience, really.
Right. Because, you know, oftentimes you think about these great teams that come together, and you're sitting in a war room somewhere with hopefully cork walls, etc., and you're sort of and a printer. And
you've been to Bloomberg,
right? Yeah, no, exactly. there are no rooms. There's, I mean, if there are walls, or glass, that's for sure. but so were you working then? Really, you've got the brief from Josh. But were you working in isolation? Then, as you said, and there were what, you three ideas, two.
Okay. There were two. The one, which was the one that, I mean, originally what Josh wanted to do was to kind of was to break it down much more kind of fundamentally into kind of, I think, probably about anything up to 12 sections. So there'd be 12. Right. So, and then much more kind of like a website, really. So there would be each kind of each category. So economics, politics and whatnot, would, and even down through to kind of sport and things.
Right.
They got kind of edited down into those five sections that we begin the magazine with, which is kind of economics, politics, technology. I mean, my other pitch, actually, which it was to do a magazine as a newspaper, was just to sort of to pace it completely differently.
Right. Not as format, though. I mean, you were...
No, just... I mean, like a newspaper paces itself. There are kind of magazine conventions that have, you know, you have a front of book, middle of book, back of book, etc.
Yeah.
And I thought that might be interesting just to kind of to challenge that and just to pace it in terms of just stories, which, you know as you kind of pace a newspaper. I mean, coming from a newspaper, I guess.
Sure. So. And let's bring that to theme of the week, cover, then. So what were the two cover approaches? And did one of them win, or the current, the current cover we've come to know and love with Bloomberg Business Week now, was that an evolution?
Yeah, well, it's been an evolution over the last four years. I mean, there was never, of those two options we're just discussing, they were both kind of fairly similar. They were just, you know, there was just a slight kind of different type treatments and whatnot. But the cover has just evolved into sort of something kind of a bit weird. We, at no point did we ever think, right, we've got to do all these great covers, or we've got to be kind of known for this, you know, for covers.
Yeah.
That's just been a kind of a gradual sort of evolution of what we do at the magazine. I mean, we didn't really kind of get significant kind of traction with what we were kind of doing and a kind of confidence in what we were doing until probably about a year in, really. I think it took us a while just to sort of understand the magazine. I mean, throughout that year, there are times when, you know, you just have these small little victories. You kind of do something which feels a little bit different. People like it, and you move on from there. And I think that was very much what happened with the cover, is that it was just a sort of a series of kind of little steps and incremental steps. And then it kind of, you know, the cover sort of has evolved now into this kind of event. Every week there is this kind of moment where you can release the cover, and then, you know, we sort of dive in on that and try to amplify that kind of one moment, you know.
Well, that's what's interesting, I guess, going back to the development period, was there always a sense of singularity? Because, you know, some good covers, you know, will succeed on just one theme. Others will, of course, gain traction and attract readers because, yeah, I might go with the main theme, but you're also selling me four or five other things as well. So was there always the sense that you would just have sort of, you know, just let's go for sort of the one strong statement, or was there one that was also pointing you to other things? Because I think what's the magic of what you do every week is that, yeah, you just, you put your neck out there and you are either going to like the topic that we're going after or not. Regardless, hopefully you're attracted to the magazine, you're going to pick it up, or you're going to get it regardless, you know, no matter what. So I'm just wondering, was there ever a sort of a sense that should we sort of be hedging our bets as well by trying to pull people in with a couple of other...
Well, we initially started off with a series of kind of cover lines at the top of the top of the cover, but I think increasingly, occasionally we just sort of took them off, and we sort of, and I think we just sort of liked it a little bit more when we took it off. It just felt a bit more committed. And then we started just to refer to those cover lines kind of like broccoli at the top of, you know, it felt like it was good for you, and it felt like there was, you know, it showed you there are things in the magazine.
Yeah.
But ultimately it denied you a little bit of impact. And but there was never really a kind of a big discussion, just, okay, we're going to go for one story. It was just a series of experiments, really. And to a certain extent, that's still what we're doing. You know, it's kind of just trying to experiment and kind of do different things, or at least try and push ourselves to do different things each week. But also you have to kind of bear in mind that our, you know, the way that people buy the magazine, I mean, we have a very small newsstand presence, you know, in terms, I mean, that we have, a, you know, it, the newsstand in the States is even worse than it is over here. I can't remember, I don't know the actual percentage, but I think it's about some 90-95% of our readers subscribe. So it's a slightly kind of different relationship that you, that you build through that, because, you know, you have this thing coming in through your mailbox and, you know, it's important to shout in that instance. You know, you're not really trying to, you know, they've already bought the thing.
Yeah.
And so you just really want to get them to kind of to pick it up and kind of, and I think we just sort of felt that that one story was a better way of doing that.
You're listening to The Stack. This is the 83rd edition and you are listening to Monocle 24.
The coffee has been supped, the shelves perused, and the service sampled, and the votes are in for Monocle's first ever retail awards.
It might seem counterintuitive calling Stockholm's old town up and coming, but the past few years have seen Stockholmers turn their attention back to the area. For too long, the cobblestone alleys and arched cellars were the sole property of souvenir shops and second-rate pizzerias. Now, ambitious restaurateurs are leading the way to a new age.
Find out just what it is that makes one shop stand out from the other by watching our Top 25 Retail Survey, now playing on monocle.com.
And it's a Saturday here in London, in Studio 2 here at Midori House. You are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé, and my very, very special guest, Richard Turley of Bloomberg's Business Week. And he's, you mentioned W.H. Smith before he went away, and you've even got the sound effects of sort of the nice sort of, in a scratchy, sort of, you know, wrinkly W.H. Smith bag. There it is.
There you are.
I guess we've got a bit of a masterclass coming up, because we're going to talk to our own Richard Spencer Powell, our own creative director, a little bit later. But want to start? I mean, you've got the most extraordinary array of things in there. So.
Well, I was just asked to you know, the last minute, just to sort of buy a few things with those, I like the cover of. That's Wire magazine. I thought that's kind of quite a weird cover.
Yeah.
I love Garage magazine. I wanted to talk a little bit actually about The Economist, because there's been a lot of, there's been a lot of kind of people sort of slagging off, you know, sort of getting a bit stuck into The Economist. And I want to, you know, defend The Economist. It's, you know, what's not to love about Putin half naked in a tank? For me, that delivers.
Yeah, no, this is, this is last week's cover. Yes, the 22nd to 28th edition. And we've become so familiar with Putin on a horse. And here he is, the New World Order. It is great because, you know, he's almost, driven over this road sign, stop. And then, of course, there's another plaque underneath it, or the West will put you on the naughty step. And that sense of just not giving a shit.
Well, I think the covers, they don't really give a shit. I think there's a kind of bullishness about their kind of undesignedness, which I think, which a lot of magazine designers kind of react to in a kind of hostile way. But I like them. I like those covers. I think they have a kind of, you would not look at that magazine and think it's anything other than The Economist, would you? I
mean, no, absolutely. Absolutely not.
Kind of stuff.
Let me go back to just what we were chatting about a little bit earlier about. So a newsstand versus a subscription market like the US is, though. When you're sitting down to do a cover, though, are you often thinking about still, you know, how is it going to exist alongside, you know, no matter where you are, whatever airport it is in the world, when Bloomberg Business Week is there, good chances you're going to have The Economist beside you, Der Spiegel on one side, you know, good competition. Time will be there.
A little bit.
Do you think about adjacencies?
No, not too much. Not too much, actually. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that we do actually is sort of ignore everybody else.
Right.
You know, and I don't think we've really kind of, you know, we've been allowed to kind of live in a little bit of a vacuum. There's no other really, I don't really think about it too much. I mean, I think we want to try and stand out. I mean, I think there are times, there are always those kind of competitive times when you know that a big story is breaking and you know that the kind of Time are going to do something, you know the Economist are going to do something, and then it's important to kind of to think a little bit strategically about what they might perhaps do. Josh is quite good at just sort of kind of filtering that, and you know, really through kind of story choice more than anything. And but you want it to kind of jump, you know, you want it to be kind of as bright and kind of provocative as you can. I mean, provocative actually being a kind of probably a better. I mean, we're not always provocative, but I think sometimes we kind of quite like to just to push it a little bit.
Well, I think we'll sort of move and just want to talk a little bit about what we do on this side, because a discussion about magazine covers would not seem right without a little, perhaps, well-deserved introspection here at Monocle. From issue one, some 7 years ago, where a Japanese Air Force pilot stared out to the horizon, to the humble gummy bear that so encapsulated our German issue in March 2013, Monocle covers have certainly done their bit to shake up the look and feel of the global newsstand. As the first of our magazine masterclasses, analyzing various key aspects of the design and editorial process behind the creation of a magazine, it seemed right to start with the cover. Monocle Creative Director Richard Spencer Powell sat down with our producer David Pleasant to discuss certain do's and don'ts when it comes to designing that successful front cover.
What's the very first step in your experience as a designer when you're thinking of the cover for the latest issue? What's the kind of very, very first thing you have to do?
I think the very first thing you have to do is swap your design cap. Cover design and the inside of a magazine design are kind of two different schools. One is the inside is follows lots of rules. It's very rigid. You have a style to follow, which you have to do diligently. On the front cover, you have to generate sales. You have to be louder. You have to be noisier. And it often is a much kind of louder, brighter version of what is inside. It needs to encapsulate everything that's within the magazine, but it has to do it in a nice, glossy, shiny way, which is quite difficult if you're a somber magazine or if you're trying to be serious. So it's first things first, you have to kind of change your design rules in a way.
Already we can kind of see a bit of a conflict, as it were. So you're trying to sell the magazine, but also maintain something of the brand and the theme and the tone of the magazine. And if we're talking about a magazine like Monocle, for instance, that obviously has a certain tone, a certain principle and kind of ethic. So maybe let's talk technically about how you might go about delivering this thing that really jumps out at you on the newsstand.
Well, technically, you can often use a different paper stock. So Monocle is uncoated paper, but our cover stock is gloss, which means it's shinier. In fact, most magazines deploy an additional ink, what's referred to as a fifth colour, a Pantone ink. Now, this can be lots of things. It can be fluorescent. It can be brighter than normal inks. It can be metallic. It can even be a foil. So you can make your cover stand out, be shinier, brighter, more reflective, and again, louder. And for lots of people, it's about that's how you kind of raise the volume and grabs people's attention. It doesn't always work, and there isn't an exact science to covers. Lots of people think the brighter and louder you are, the more you'll sell. But often, I think the key is to be able to surprise people. Not just the passers-by on the newsstand, but also your readership. So every time that a new issue comes out, they know about it, and it's enticing and exciting. And sometimes you can do that by being very, very simple. And sometimes a simple cover will stand out much more if it's sat in a field of noisy, loud covers.
And if we look at the newsstand generally, what surprises you or jumps out at you sometimes? Can we talk about trends? Can we talk about something that perhaps has been happening lately? I mean, we're seeing this kind of flourish of independent magazine publishing, each of them with very respectable, very good design principles. Are you seeing some good covers or some good styles of covers? We don't have to name names, but just kind of themes.
I mean, I can name a few names. I think Bloomberg Businessweek does a good job because it does do surprising things. And it's a simplicity there. The message is simple. It catches your attention. It makes you think. I think they do a good job there. Not always, because they're a weekly. And I think that challenge is very hard to sustain. And there's not a lot of budget. So often with no budget, you can't always produce an image as bespoke and crisp and as how you'd like it. I think the trend in, say, the UK or maybe global men's market over the last decade is put a girl on the cover, probably a good-looking one who's got a film coming out quite soon. And that's a trend that I've seen dipping more and more. More and more men's magazines are putting male stars on their covers.
If we go back to the kind of the technical thing, it's hard not to talk about Monocle with you. I know we don't want to only talk about Monocle, but I think a lot of people, what they tend to say about Monocle covers is how perhaps text-heavy they are and how much information there might be on the cover. And I guess this is where perhaps the relationship with the editorial comes in a lot. And you're obviously having discussions with the editor-in-chief, other editors, to kind of get that side of the message across as well. How does that figure in with the visuals?
It's a funny story, the Monocle cover. I mean, we started off and it was very simple, and bit by bit we've added into them. And the challenge has always been to kind of be this very, I think, quite classy, informative magazine, and to keep the information controlled and neat and tidy. But there is a lot of information. It's increased and increased and increased. But you end up with quite a complicated cover. But I always try and balance it and make sure there's enough order there that it isn't complicated. It doesn't feel too dense. But of course, it is dense. You should be able to read the information easily. And I think we've got to that point because Monocle is a complicated magazine. There's a lot in it. You know, there's five major sections plus an expo, plus there's various supplements that we run. And I think what you try and do for a Monocle cover is we'll try and pick an image that will encapsulate the theme of the issue. And that sometimes that's a very set theme. It might be about design, or it might be about transport. It might be about quality of life, or it might be about something completely different, like dogs in Japan or, you know, the North Pole. But we try and choose an image and a graphic style that kind of encapsulates what everyone in the editorial floor are doing that month.
Monocle and some other magazines, if we talk about something like National Geographic, for instance, they have a certain key kind of parameters and a kind of something that doesn't shift format. So if we talk about Monocle, for instance, there are certain things that wouldn't ever change from month to month. What are they? I mean, if we talk about the black, the border, that kind of thing. So there's something you start with.
There's something you start with. I personally would like to challenge it a little more, maybe. I quite like it when people break their own rules. I mean, some famous examples are Harper's Bazaar, where they'll, you know, the models, you know, used a hand in the air and sort of messed with the logo kind of thing. The Esquire covers of the 60s were very kind of provocative, and they challenged, you know, what they did with the logo. I think it's the strength of your brand if you can challenge those a little bit. That said, I wouldn't change the black, you know, ever. I think that's one constraint, and I guess the logo and the bar across the top. But we have done, occasionally, we've broken the actual format, the window aperture where the main image sits. I think it's issue 35, you go back, it breaks out of that mold. I quite like it when things do that. And this month, actually, is a little departure. We usually always have eye contact if you're using a model on the cover, and that's sort of one of these unwritten cover rules, which, again, if you break it, suddenly it looks new. So in this instance, we've kind of broken a rule there that we shouldn't do. There are lots of, you know, if you want to talk technical things, there's lots of cover rules that are kind of myth, I think. You shouldn't really do a black cover, and you shouldn't do a black and white cover, and you shouldn't use a green colour on your cover, because all these things apparently damage sales. But if you do it in a surprising way, they're totally fine. It doesn't damage your sales at all. Luckily, I'm not the only one involved. So the editors, Tyler, Andrew, they also contribute. You know, it's a real team effort. So you're never really left to kind of repeat yourself too easily. And of course, that's, you know, that's part of the job.
That was Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell, speaking to our David Pleasant on the art of designing a great magazine cover. But of course, I have another Richard in studio. As you know, the gentleman has been with me throughout the program, Richard Turley of Bloomberg's Business Week. Before we go, just the last few minutes, what does your media diet look like? And you're moving out of The Guardian and the world of being in a daily, and again, just, you know, such a different structure to coming into Bloomberg. And it's amazing. We spend a lot of time with Bloomberg. We've had a TV show with you guys. There's been a very good relationship between our two businesses. But yet I think a lot of consumers, you know, whether you're sitting, you know, in Singapore, Germany, even the US, don't realize the size and scale of Bloomberg when it comes to just network of correspondents. And just how sort of, you know, muscular the organization is. So what was that move like, I guess, first and foremost, from Guardian to there? And I guess the second thing is, how has that maybe changed your consumption habits of media as well?
Well, there's so many differences about kind of moving from The Guardian to, you know, and it's also the move from London to New York. And, you know, there's a lot of kind of different things kind of caught up in that. I mean, American magazines are a lot bigger, take themselves much more seriously. Over here, I think newspapers kind of sometimes feel a little bit more kind of boring, a bit more stable, whereas magazines kind of, you know, it's less so. Whereas over there, kind of there's, you know, there's really no newspaper. two newspapers.
Yeah.
And so, that was a kind of a, you know, it was different. I mean, but then so many things were kind of different. I mean, the way that we kind of put the magazine together was I worked at G2, so I was used to doing a magazine a day. So it definitely kind of slowed, you know, that kind of pace was kind of, you know, slower. But then in other ways, you know, they do like to work hard, you know.
Right.
So there wasn't really, you know, there's not exactly kind of much let up. I mean, Bloomberg, it did feel as if, you know, they have money. Now they've cracked the subscription model pretty,
sure.
pretty convincingly.
Yeah.
You know, 20,000 for a terminal, you know. So,
yeah.
So,
and just for people who are not listening, that's not 20,000 to subscribe to Bloomberg Business Week. That's to have the screen on your desk.
Yeah. So, I mean, and they cracked the subscription models in the mid 80s. And so, you know, what we do as a magazine is almost kind of advertising. It's kind of media as advertising
right.
for the kind of the terminal. That's how Mike Bloomberg sees it. That's how the business that he's kind of developed.
And have you been, let's say, not sort of sucked into the terminal world as well, but is that part of your life as well?
Well, my email comes through the terminal, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you can't not go, everything in Bloomberg goes through the terminal in
right.
some respect. If I want to turn the air conditioning up, it has to go through the terminal. So, yeah, no, I mean, it's unescapable. You know, it's a sort of a 360 sort of degree world that you live in, and on the terminal is every point of it. You know, in terms of it kind of being an enormous company, it's you know, you do feel like you get taken seriously, and it's nice to sort of to feel looked after a little bit. And, you know, it feels like a sort of, you sort of imagine what working at a company should be like. You know, they look after you, and you know, there's no kind of, you know, dread and panic about,
yeah.
you know, are they going to close, or kind of, you know, what's going to, you know, is the money going to run out, and, you know.
And you've got the Beasley terminal sitting on your desk, but just before we go, what does Richard Turley's, you know, daily media diet look like?
Well, I'm still reading The Guardian every day. I mean, that's where I sort of my primary news source. I mean, my favorite.
And you're reading it online. You're not
on the line. Yeah. And I mean, my favorite magazine is New York Magazine.
Even now in a bi-weekly format.
I don't mind it. I like it. I like it. I mean, I think that it's, I think they kind of quite sensibly didn't do too much and just made the
picture,
you know, and, you know, I do actually like it. I think it's good. I mean, I think Jody Kwan, who's the picture editor there, is, you know, and I think Adam Moss is a complete genius.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, they are, you know, I really like that magazine. I tend to kind of buy small magazines. I'm a bit of a, you know, I don't.
Do you have a favorite newsstand in New York?
Casa,
mate.
I live in Hudson.
Very near and dear.
Yeah, but there's actually quite. There's a couple up in Lexington. I don't know their names, but there's so we're on kind of 58th and Lexington.
Well, I think that's the amazing thing is, I mean, we do have good newsstands, you know, in London. There's many newsstands, but I do think that is one area that New York, you know, beats the city.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
And the consistency of so many neighborhoods having just, you know, great places to go and drop $100 on good print.
And believe me, I do that.
Don't we all? Richard Turley, we have to leave it there.
Okay.
Very, very good seeing you.
Thank you for having me.
And that brings us to the end of this 83rd edition of The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé. Special thanks to our guest today, Richard Turley of Bloomberg's Business Week. Our producer today, David Pleasant, and behind the glass here at Midori House, Studio 2, was our studio managers, Claire Urban and Sean Malervi. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time when we'll be hearing from the Netherlands and the International Independent Magazine Biennale in Arnhem. Remember, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes or SoundCloud. But for now, for me, goodbye.